The following panel discussion is entitled Politics, Race, and Nation, What Immigration Reform Means. The talk was recorded at USC on April 26, 2006. The first speaker is David Lloyd, USC professor of English.
This forum has been stimulated quite obviously by recent debates and demonstrations around the question of immigration. Stimulated themselves by the Sensenbrenner bill in Congress, number H.R. 4437. According to the National Council of La Raza, this bill would firstly make it more difficult for legal immigrants to become U.S. citizens. Secondly, disrupt American communities and put all Americans at risk, legal risk that is, by broadening the definition of smuggling to include anyone who aids or transports an undocumented immigrant. Thirdly, make everyone who comes to the U.S. to work subject not only to deportation, but to imprisonment in the U.S. And fourthly, disrupt the U.S. economy by creating an overly broad and retroactive employment verification system without creating legal channels for needed workers to work lawfully. In reaction to this draconian legislation that has just passed through Congress, over the past few weeks, 500,000 people came out in the streets of L.A., 500,000 in Dallas, 200,000 in D.C., not to mention 3,000 in Garden City, Kansas, with a population of 30,000. This may have been the most remarkable manifestation of organized civic dissent this nation has ever seen, and I think I'm not alone in saluting those who organized and participated, and in honoring the high school students and others who had the courage to walk out of school or off their jobs to defend their rights and the rights of others. These demonstrations were attended by people who have their origins in many countries and continents, citizens and non-citizens alike. This is, after all, a nation of immigrants, forced and voluntary, a nation founded on the theft of land and the genocide of indigenous peoples who occupied it and who recognized no borders, a nation made wealthy by the toil of slaves, of the indentured laborers, of immigrants and workers. And yet the recent debate continues to be framed as if it affected only the Latino population of this country, Mexicans, Central Americans, Latin Americans. It is indeed, of course, along the Mexican border that a 2,000-mile iron curtain is proposed, and it is primarily the 11 million undocumented workers from south of that border who will be penalized and criminalized. Little mention, for example, has been made of the thousands of undocumented immigrants from my own country, Ireland. And equally little mention has been made at the moment of the plight of immigrants from Haiti, a nation interfered with over and over again by American interventions and invasions. But what's more important still, and the reason for our panel, is the fact that immigration continues to be a confused and isolated issue. It appears as if immigration affects most of the population only so far as immigrants are accused of taking away jobs from Americans and lowering their wages. Perhaps, moreover, in the overheated imaginations of a few of the Minutemen, immigrants are the first wave of the Reconquista, que viva. Immigration has been the latest of a series of issues that seem to have swept across the headlines, each one displacing the previous day's concerns. Beneath them all is the specter of a failing economy as well as a failing presidency, the constant drumbeat of crisis, and the anxiety as to the future of American capitalism in a world where not only outsourced jobs, but the very center of gravity of economic activity may well be shifting to China or to India, while the Earth's resources, especially in oil and water, seem to be ever shrinking. We tend to confront and deal with all these issues, if we do at all, as separate and disconnected ones. The speed and soundbite quality of our news media encourages us to do so. Our panel today has been asked to talk briefly to the connections among these issues, to reflect on how they relate to one another, both historically and in the present moment. And with an eye on the May 1st walkout and boycott, in which I hope everyone here will participate, how can we respond without being forced once again to divide and oppose one another? What possibilities are there of making coalitions across the divides that are imposed upon us? I think our panelists will speak to these and other issues in their own fashion, and then the floor will be open to your comments and your questions. The panelists are, and they will speak in this order, Ayanna McNair, who's a graduate student here in cinema and TV, Ricardo Ramirez, assistant professor in political science and the program in American Studies and Ethnicity, Fred Moten, who's professor of English and American Studies and current chair of African American Studies, and Janelle Wong, professor of political science and American Studies. Thank you all.
Thank you. Greetings, everyone. Black folks are at war in this country, but the battle isn't against immigration, and the enemy is not undocumented workers, as you may have been duped into believing by corporate media. What is happening today has been going on for centuries, imperialism. Workers have been exploited for low, unlivable wages in the name of insatiable corporate profits. Since its inception, the U.S. has sacrificed the lives of people of color in its path towards global domination under a system of ruthless capitalism. The same capitalistic system that justifies slavery, which has been transformed over the years into prison industrial complex, is now not only justifying the continued exploitation of low-wage, undocumented workers, but creates the problem of illegal immigration in the first place. The struggle for immigrant rights has been brewing for quite some time. The recent H.R. 4437, aka the Sensenbrenner Bill, which seeks to criminalize undocumented workers, is not only racist policy, but also a dangerous policy, for it will turn the struggle to provide for one's family into a criminal act and turn what purports to be a free, democratic society into a police state, where anyone who fits the profile of an undocumented worker is an open target. The U.S. is being very two-faced on this issue. It benefits from keeping these workers undocumented so that they can be exploited for cheap labor, but at the same time does not want the public to know that it exploits workers. So it presents immigration as this overwhelming problem. The recent immigrant rights marches and rallies are a result of immigrants finally being sick and tired of being the scapegoats for society's ills. Undocumented workers are not fleeing their countries of origin and making a difficult trek into the U.S. so that they can listen to Britney Spears and go to Disneyland. People are suffering in their home countries as a result of policies that come out of Washington, D.C., including trade agreements such as NAFTA and CAFTA, which is Central American Free Trade Agreement, which allow greedy U.S. corporations to exploit workers across the globe free of consequence. When you consider how bad conditions have to be to force people to leave their homes and work in the U.S. for pennies, or the fact that scores of Africans die every year at the hands of diamond cartels so that you can stay blinged up, you begin to see that poor people who are struggling to survive and feed their families are suffering worldwide so that a wealthy elite ruling class can keep getting richer. Black folks, an expendable segment of this society, as the police murder of Amadou Diallo illustrates, must recognize that we have no interest in defending racist policies driven by white conservatives that only benefit business elites, policies that seek to divide the working class. In order for black liberation to ever become a reality, we must remain focused on the true source of our oppression, which is not other oppressed workers, but rather the elite capitalistic power structure that seeks to exploit workers in the quest to further the cause of U.S. global domination. In the end, we're struggling for the same thing, equality. Thank you.
What was some of the first things that came out in Los Angeles Times and some of the mainstream media? They turned to race, you know. It started with immigrants, and they said, where are African Americans? That's all. That was the primary question that we kept hearing. I wanted to expand it. It's not just where were African Americans, where were progressive Jews, where were the labor unions, where were a lot of people? The question is, they weren't there. Why weren't they there? Now I want to tie it back into something that she said. Well, the reality is with a lot of these immigrants, they came here and are working hard, but one of the things that they're doing is keeping some of the cultural ties. They're not here listening to Britney Spears. They're listening to some of the music from their home country to maintain some of those cultural ties. So it makes sense that when an issue that directly impacts immigrants comes to the fore, where is it that they're able to mobilize around? Spanish language media, Spanish language radio in particular. So it's not surprising that that's the source of the mobilization that they had to realize, you know, if the LAPD said there were 500,000 people there, we pretty much know it was more around 700,000 people. But it's because they mobilized using Spanish language media that a lot of these civil rights groups that were around during the civil rights movement weren't there. Because of the language that was used to mobilize. So, how many of you have heard of the name Piolin? How about El Cucuy? How many of those same people that just raised your hands knew those names before the incidents that happened?
You forgot El Mandril.
Yeah, El Mandril, right? Yeah. Now, I'm going to pose an even harder question. How many of you know the name El Peladillo? That's a lot less people, right? So the reality is that in Los Angeles, this isn't a new phenomenon of using media to mobilize immigrants. It was already done. Think back to the early 1990s. What was the biggest thing that happened? There was a new radio station, KLAX, and it took everybody by surprise by the number of listeners that they had and that they were able to mobilize. And that morning show became the top-rated morning show in all the country. And there was a backlash by the mainstream media, by Rick Dees, you know, suggesting like, oh, basically saying it's a bunch of illegals listening to this music. He got a lot, there was a lot of backlash to his comments, but the reality was there was that sense that they could use this media to mobilize. Now, did they use it the same way the second go-around? No, they didn't. There was a wider variety, and what they used it for during the mid-1990s, in 1994 in particular, was El Peladillo and his co-host of the morning, they vilified Pete Wilson. And now, they weren't the only ones responsible for vilifying Pete Wilson, but they brought him into the minds of a lot of people in the policies that he wanted to proceed with. So it was used in the early and mid-1990s, and it was used now. The way that the issues are being framed between the mainstream media and Spanish language media are really, I guess, they're really set apart, and there's a big drift between them, where the mainstream media keeps wanting to make it into a race issue. Now, I pose it to you guys, you know, and I hope that this will come up. How much of this actually has to do with race? How much of it is with immigration? How can we disentangle both of them? Because a lot of times these issues wind in with one another. So it's one thing that I hope we discuss.
It's just in the spirit of asking y'all, you know, obnoxious questions about who you've heard of and who not. And the reason I say it's obnoxious is because I always do this in my class and they always get mad at me because they're like, why should I have heard of this music you were listening to in 1967? But how many of y'all know who Fannie Lou Hamer is? Okay. Well, the reason I bring Fannie Lou Hamer up, she was a woman who worked as a sharecropper on a plantation in a town in the Mississippi Delta called Ruleville. And she decided, along with some other people who she worked with in 1963, to attempt to register to vote in Indianola, Mississippi, which was the county seat for the county that she lived in. And she was arrested, beaten, basically because she made a decision to refuse to accept what she called second-class citizenship. She's a hero of the civil rights movement. She founded something called the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, which challenged the legitimacy of the Mississippi Democratic Party at the 1964 Democratic Convention in Atlantic City. She wanted to be seated as the legitimate representatives of the state, insofar as she felt that the Mississippi Democratic Party was illegitimate because they refused to acknowledge the right to political participation on the part of a vast number of that state's citizens. So a whole lot of what Mrs. Hamer was about was attempting to refuse the ongoing refusal of her rights as a citizen. But once the Voting Rights Act was passed and once black folks in Mississippi had at least more access to political participation, she didn't stop her activism. She spoke out, for instance, against the Vietnam War strenuously. There's a famous speech of hers at the University of California, Berkeley, in which she basically, I think, is moving beyond refusing to accept second-class citizenship into an even more radical political stance, which is namely to refuse first-class citizenship. Insofar as what first-class citizenship has meant historically has been a kind of quiescence, a quiescent acceptance of imperial expansion at home and economic exploitation, or imperial expansion abroad and economic exploitation at home. And it seems to me that right now it's a really crucial moment in the history of Afro-American struggle, insofar as this immigration struggle gives us an opportunity, gives black folks an opportunity to act as if we were going to follow in the footsteps of Mrs. Hamer, which means not just to refuse second-class citizenship, but refuse first-class citizenship as it has already been constructed, right? So that if what it means to be a citizen is to get involved in all kinds of ridiculous nativist formulations about these people coming here and taking my stuff, mine, what we need to do is to refuse this ridiculous and silly and racist and evil discourse about mine, right? As if this land could be thought about under the rubric of anything like ours, right? For anybody. In other words, part of what's at stake, it seems to me, is to refuse that kind of ridiculous set of formulations which implies that citizenship is all bound up with ownership. Insofar as we know that in 1789, citizenship was deeply bound up with ownership, and the thing that was being owned was us, right? So we need to be careful and to think clearly about what kinds of historical discourses we are aligning ourselves with if we fall into the trap of a kind of nativism and a kind of anti-immigrant nativism which implies precisely the kind of citizenship that Mrs. Hamer was refusing. One of the ironies of Sensenbrenner's bill is that it criminalizes flight from the very vicious conditions of U.S. imperialism. And the irony, of course, is that when people flee from those conditions, they flee to the place which authors those conditions. Obviously, part of what's at stake, of course, is that that particular itinerary just replicates an itinerary which black folks know something about. We've been fleeing the conditions of U.S. imperialism forever ourselves. I mean, we are fugitive people, right? Not a nativist people. Or at least it seems to me that we are when we accept what is essential to the best elements of our political tradition. And it seems to me that we need to maintain that. There's this vicious irony that somehow, at the very moment when it seems as if some of us seem intent upon claiming illegitimate forms of citizenship, that there are also these battles between blacks and Latinos in prison, whether that prison is New Orleans or Folsom, right? And the battle is between folks who are basically relegated to the permanent status of non-citizens, fighting over the fruits of an illegitimate citizenship in the first place that they'll never actually have access to. And it seems to me that especially with regard to New Orleans, we need to think back to the historic convergences of African and Latin cultures that go back before Columbus, that are at the very foundations of the cultural essence of New Orleans in the first place, right? That what we need to do is to think not just about those origins, but the immediate post-Columbian nature of, let's say, Mexico. There were 500,000 African slaves that were imported into Mexico in the 16th and 17th century. We need to consider and to think about that, that there are like historical reasons why not just this particular conflict between blacks and Latinos, but the very notion that there is some fundamentally essential difference between the two groups has to be called into question, not only as a function of history, but as a function of what we claim or what we want to claim for our futures. Right? So anyway, I just want to make sure that we start to think about these things, you know, maybe in a different way. You know, start to call into question the Lou Dobbs formulation of this problem, right? Because we're more informed than Lou Dobbs, we're smarter than Lou Dobbs, you know, we look better than Lou Dobbs, and we ought not allow ourselves to be duped by Lou Dobbs, right? So I just hope what happens tonight is that we begin to formulate for ourselves some better ways and some more humane ways of thinking through this particular issue. And stop allowing ourselves to get caught up into a discourse in which we defend something called home, which was never really our home, right? And if we stop defending this already existing thing called home, we might actually make it possible for us to turn this into something that we will want to call home. So, thank you.
So there's two sheets that I'm passing out. One is on the legislation that is currently being considered in the Congress. The second has to do with two questions that I'm going to address in my remarks, which is, do immigrants take the jobs of native, especially black American workers? And do immigrants drive down wages? What does the research say? So I want to talk a little bit about the empirical evidence that is not being focused on too much in this debate, but which I think is important for us all to consider. Okay, the bill that most of the panelists have been talking about today is the Border Protection, Anti-Terrorism, and Illegal Immigration Control Act of 2005. That's a Sensenbrenner bill. Focuses it on enforcement. You keep hearing this word criminalization. It would increase civil and criminal penalties for knowingly in hiring or employing illegal workers. It establishes mandatory minimum sentences for immigrants without documents who re-enter the country. It also expands the border. So that bill really focuses on enforcement, border enforcement, and criminalization. It has passed in the House, and that's where that bill is now. The other bill that is being considered in the Senate, if you flip the page over, is the bill being sponsored by Senators McCain. McCain is the originator of this bill, and Kennedy. And that bill focuses primarily on instituting a legalization process that such that immigrants without documents who have lived in the U.S. for 5 years or more could attain citizenship if they remained employed, had background checks, etc. And then there are some different conditions for those who've been here a shorter amount of time to become citizens. It also includes a temporary worker program, and it also includes civic courses for new immigrants. This bill is at the very first stage in the legislative process introduced in the Judiciary Committee. Now, that bill needs to be worked out by the senators, and then there would be another step where the House and Senate bills would have to be reconciled somehow before any legislation moves forward. And what does President Bush want? President Bush originally emphasized border security and a guest temporary worker program. Originally, his plan did not include a legalization component, but now it does. So just to give you some background about where we are. If you look at the next sheet, I just want to talk briefly about the two issues that seem to come up the most in terms of a kind of, I think, divide and conquer politics, which is what is the threat that immigrants represent to a native population? And particularly, I think, many people who are arguing against more liberal immigration laws are putting forth the idea that perhaps immigrants might be taking away the jobs, especially of African Americans in the United States. Secondly, that they're driving down wages. And I just wanted to present some of the data. One is a false dichotomy that immigrants are not black and blacks are not immigrants. Obviously, we've had a huge wave of immigration from Africa, the Caribbean, in the last 20 years, and now census statistics show that more African immigrants have arrived since 1990 than were brought to the U.S. as slaves prior to the early 1800s. In New York City in 2000, 30% of people of African origin were foreign-born. The research by economists shows that immigration has an overall positive effect on the economy, but there's also a consensus that it is likely the case that immigrants hurt in terms of providing some kind of competition might compete for jobs with the lowest paid workers in the economy. But the argument is about the degree of that competition. So for instance, if you look at this data, a recent Rand study showed that immigrants mainly compete with those in the lowest paying sectors and depress wages by about 3%. A big study that got a lot of attention from Harvard by Borjas and Katz estimated that the effects were larger. But those same researchers also note that since 1980, of the estimated 8 million immigrants without documents that have entered the workforce, 2/3 never completed high school. Well, the percent of native-born people who have not completed high school has been shrinking rapidly, so that the point of this research is that the competition of immigrants with the native-born is immigrants competing with a smaller and smaller proportion of the native-born. And other there's a lot of conflicting data. In 2005, an economist at UC Berkeley, David Card, compared cities that have lots of less educated immigrants with cities that had very few and found no wage differences driven by immigration. In a 2001 article, a sociologist, Nelson Lim, found that there was little evidence that immigrants, that there's a direct displacement of black workers due to Latino immigrants because they're actually in different sectors of the economy. Now, he leaves open the possibility that that can change. And even if we're thinking about in those terms of displacement, I think it's also important to look at other kinds of forces that are driving competition among workers. One is that there's a very compelling study by a famous sociologist, Roger Waldinger at UCLA, where he shows that it's employer attitudes that often drive who gets hired in jobs, and that employers are likely to see Latinos as a passive, pliable workforce compared to African Americans, who he found evidence that employers were looking at African Americans as a more demanding workforce that was going to be always asking for higher wages, and that this was really one of the forces that was driving competition and driving African Americans out of particular sectors. Do immigrants pay more taxes than they cost in public services? Most, but not all, studies seem to be persuaded that immigrants pay more taxes than they receive in public services. But it's quite nuanced in that there are some studies that show if immigrants have children, and you're looking at those immigrants that have kids who are under 20 years old, if their kids are in public school, then those immigrants might be using some services than they are paying in taxes. But this is only looking at that particular family, not in the direct cost of the taxes you're paying, the services you're using. It does not account for the fact that immigrants might be creating new jobs, that immigrants are spending their money on supporting local economies. And it doesn't take into the fact that immigrants actually increase the purchasing power quite a bit of the most well-off, as they provide very cheap services for the well-off. So I just wanted to end with this interesting public opinion data I found yesterday, which shows that a recent March 2006 survey, which was a rigorous survey, shows that blacks were more likely than whites to say that they believe that immigrants are taking jobs away from Native Americans, but that blacks were also more likely to say that they didn't think that immigration should be cut back. So it's a fairly complex story, and I think we only hear part of the story. Secondly, a more recent field poll conducted this month shows that more blacks than Latinos support giving undocumented workers the opportunity to become citizens. And that was quite striking to me. More blacks than Latinos and more blacks than whites support liberalizing our citizenship laws. So I'll end there.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. You can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org.